This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Taking Heat.
General Ludd.
The Stern Matriarch.
And Bartitsu.
Robin, I just saw a tuxedo cat change into a red cape, then leap off the town hall clock tower. Have I been sniffing too much catnip?
You just saw a super kitty, Ken. We're not in River City anymore. Welcome to Meowtropolis, the brand new superhero setting for the Magical Kitties Save the Day RPG.
Super kitties? I thought magical was already pretty impressive. You're telling me these cats have secret identities now, too?
Precisely. In Meowtropolis, your kitty is a caped crusader, protecting the bustling city from diabolical supervillains. We're talking secret hideouts, origin stories, and power quirks that add the earth-shattering kaboom to your series.
Sounds like the stakes just got a whole lot higher. And the best part... The Meowtropolis Kickstarter is live right now.
We've got the Meowtropolis Hometown Book, the Trouble in River City Adventure Collection, and even a new solo puzzle book called Mice's Gambit.
This is obviously the one I've been waiting for, but Kickstarter campaigns don't last forever. We'd better pounce on those rewards before the clock runs out.
Head to atlas-games.com/backmeow. To get your super kitty supplements before they're gone. That's atlas-games.com/backmeow. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, and the beautiful, sleek parquet floor in our top-secret safe house tell us we're once more in the gaming hut. But it's a specific gaming hut because beloved Patreon backer Manfred Gabriel is here for a follow-up question. He asked us for assistance with his Dracula dossier campaign a while back. And now his characters have gotten into trouble, and he wants us, and I think mostly you, Ken, to provide some tips on how to keep them in the right amount of trouble. So there's been a lot of shooting and attracting attention going on. How do I model what the authorities know, keep heat rolls interesting, and put pressure on the team? And I think we're going to widen this out to not just other campaigns, but other games, because this is always the trick when the bad guys are pursuing the player characters, which is how do you keep the right amount of pressure on them? Too little, it doesn't feel like a suspense thriller. Too much, and they grow disconsolate, and suddenly they're turtling. So what are your main tips for striking that balance?
My main tips for striking the balance, and first of all, in Dracula Dossier, the authorities are not necessarily the bad guys. The authorities are often just, you know, regular old cops or counterterrorism forces or whoever, Interpol agents, that kind of thing, who just know that a bunch of scruffy strangers with a Ural pass have started blowing up the train station everywhere and they have to go after him. So the bad guy heat is a different order than that kind of heat, than the sort of civilian heat, or I guess, you know, LEO heat, because bad guy heat is fairly easy to modulate because the whole point of the game is to end in a big confrontation between the good guys and the bad guys. And so the bad guys can sort of drive the players like they rented them, in the sense that they can force confrontations, they can do ambushes, they can, you know, set booby traps, they can invade safe houses. Bad guys can do all manner of things to drive the players either out of a comfortable turtling or toward a confrontation that makes dramatic sense that the cops can't necessarily do. And what the cops are there to do in Knights Black Agents is, first of all, try to encourage the players to think of a thing besides blow up the train station to solve their problems. But secondly, to cut them off from other sources of aid if they have angered the conspiracy, so that they are now, they can't go to anybody else. And just like in the thriller, only the hero can solve the problem. They've cut off their connections to the outside world that might otherwise be sympathetic to a story of evil vampires trying to drink everybody.
Right. Because in the movies, your Jason Bournes, your Bonds, sort of modulate the amount of attention that they attract to themselves. Either the script doesn't really care, or they exhibit some sort of degree of caution. But we're talking about player characters. So
right.
In Manfred's case, for example, they shot a Duke of Edom with a sniper rifle at a Romanian dig site. And the Romanian authorities, if you don't want them to jump in, you've got to come up with a reason for that to make sense. How do you determine when you want the authorities to jump in and complicate things, and when you don't? As a GM, I've been surprised by my players getting out the sniper rifle at this point. I should have expected it. They said they had one.
Right.
But here we go. How do I decide in the moment what degree of authorities getting involved happens?
I mean, the first thing that you want to do ideally, and this is what, you know, Jason Bourne always steals a radio so he knows what's going on with the cops. Make sure that the players have some way of, at least, even if they reject that way, even if they say, we don't need any stinking radios, then, you know, that's on them. But in theory, the advantage and the disadvantage of the police is that everything that they do goes out over the air, and it goes out maybe over a teletype in Romania, as opposed to if they're sending the secret police after you, but it'll go out. There's going to be some degree of radio warning to alert players. And so that can be enough with many players, that this is get off the dime or stop screwing around and do the thing you came to this scene for, because your stolen radio tells you the cops are 5 minutes out. And then, you know, it tells you they're 2 minutes out if you're still dinking around instead of, you know, stealing the safe or murdering the elderly Hungarian or whatever it was that you came here to do. And that acts as a tension creator, tension maintainer, and a choke point on screwing around to sort of force fast pacing. Then the second sort of tier of things is, in this case, maybe there's a Romanian security official who's marked them down. He's going to take them down, or an Interpol guy, whatever it is. And that becomes an NPC, and you play them like you play any other NPC, and you provide spur and evidence, and you begin to, you know, find that in the LEO communications, and maybe you even find it in conspiracy communications. They're like, do we have a guy? Is that our guy? No, this is a civilian. This is an extra. What do? Do we turn him? Do we drink him and get all of his information? And that can set up a fine flip scenario. So the vampires are like, this Interpol guy knows all about these hunters. Let's just drink him and take his information. If the players are inside either party's loop, they can intervene in that, save the Interpol guy, and at the very least get a little of their heat postponed, if not taken off. And maybe they just make it worse because, as you say, player characters, but it gives you some tactical options. And that's sort of the key element in this, is that the LEO heat exists to give the GM tactical options, whereas players get tactical options from knowing things about their foes. And obviously, again, the thing about LEOs is they have terrible security. So it's very easy to know things about them, even just with a spend of military science. You're like, oh yeah, we cross-trained with the Romanian Interior Police back in my NATO days. I know all about their search patterns. And you can just go ahead and have that information, and it lets you know which communication shack to hit, or which guy is likely to be the spotter, or whatever else you might need to know to get out of a scene.
Right. And for listeners who haven't yet played Knights Black Agents, heat is a number that goes up
right
as the players do things that attract attention, like going around shooting people. And so the implication is that as that number gets higher, the whole system is built to that is basically the price that you are meant to pay, the trade-off as a player character. If you thought about whether you're going to shoot that guy before you did, you're supposed to be thinking, do I really want this much heat? And so the system is telling you, make sure that there is a consequence to this, because it's in response to a choice the players have made, and they should absolutely get more heat, even if it might make them sad and depressed later. Mm. And so it's relatively easy to think of more things that happen than to think of why they might not. Although there are lots of, you know, if you need fewer things to happen, there are all sorts of reasons why, you know, local or federal law enforcement would mess things up, including they could well also be penetrated by the vampire conspiramid. I think I also enjoyed your implication earlier that you can throw a curve to the players since they're listening in on the cops and they're hearing all the chatter, and suddenly they hear screams and they hear this horrible thing happening that maybe they didn't wish on the law enforcement people chasing them. But if they've thought about their situation at all, they know, well, this is going to make things worse now too, isn't it? Because maybe the next time they run into the local Romanian security guards at the dig site, they will have glowing eyes and fangs, or they'll be all Renfieldized or something, so that you can cross the streams of the mundane secondary antagonists and the vampiric main antagonists.
And since it's basically structured as a conspiracy thriller, those sorts of boundaries should always be a little bit murky. You should always wonder, is there a guy in the cops that's paid off by the conspiracy or Renfielded by the conspiracy or whatever? And that, you know, is the other reason to not attract too much attention from conventional law enforcement. Because even if the vampires haven't noticed that it's you blowing up those train stations, their guys in the cops will start feeding the intel upstairs, and eventually the main vampires will take notice of you. And that's another reason not to get heat. Basically, heat is the cop stars that show up in Grand Theft Auto. That's what the model is the more mayhem you get into in Grand Theft Auto, the more shields you get or police stars, more cops are going to come after you. The way you lose those in Grand Theft Auto is to go underground or do smaller, lower profile missions. There's ways in the book that suggest how to get rid of heat. Worst case scenario, leave the jurisdiction. Get out of Romania for a while. Go to somewhere that is at odds with Romania, like a Russian-occupied Transnistria. That'll keep you safe from the Romanians. I mean, it'll have its other problems, but the Romanians won't be following you there, so that's nice.
Right, and you won't rashly shoot anybody there. You'll have learned your lesson.
That'd be crazy. Why would you do that in the face of Putin's occupation forces? Why would you start just massacring people at random in Transnistria? There's no reason.
Well, since there's everything is calm and safe in Transnistria, we can declare an end to this segment and wander over to that yonder hill with a commercial in front of it and see what hut stands upon it. Ballad Hunters, the gumshoe game of folk songs going supernaturally wrong on the gritty side of the Regency era, is on Kickstarter until April 16th.
Britain, 1813.
Across the island, the folk ballads of the common people are coming to life.
The dead walk, dragons rise, lovers betray one another, authorities condemn innocence to die. Whatever happens in the song happens in real life.
In Ballad Hunters, you play amateur folklorists working as agents of the crown.
It's up to you, armed with a little ballad magic, to decipher the clues in each song and keep people alive long enough to change the ending.
Designed by Tristan Zimmerman, whose spin on Gumshoe was so brilliant and radical, we had to create a new line for it.
You arrive knowing something is wrong.
You hear someone sing the song.
Reality bends to its structure.
You find textual interpretations, then act on them.
The GM responds in the spirit of yes and.
The ending is never guaranteed.
Singing at the table is optional, but encouraged.
Group singing is a joy, and Ballad Hunters is a perfect excuse to sing a song with your friends.
Now on Kickstarter from Pelgrane Press.
Sing it, Ken!
Now on Kickstarter from Pelgrane Press. The glowering statues on their plinths, the wreaths of laurel hanging on the walls, and the sarsen stones rising on the hilltop tell us that we have entered that most terrifying and awesome of huts, the Mythology Hut. And today, the Mythology Hut has been activated by song, Robin. People are singing, but not the Homeric hymn to Apollo, not the Egyptian hymn to Aten. Nope, they're singing a folk song about General Ludd. And they're singing that because they are playing, or perhaps are the bad guys in, Ballad Hunters, the brand new gumshoe game from Tristan Zimmerman, out in Kickstarter even now.
Yes. And so Tristan's focus in his version of the Regency era, the game is set in 1813, is on the gritty side of things. And one of the things he's most interested in is the class struggle and the difficulty of the working man in a difficult period of history. And in response to a difficult era of history, a relatively new mythological figure has arisen. We may spend some time defining exactly what a mythological figure is, because maybe he's just a symbol. Maybe he's a propaganda idea. Maybe he's a mascot. Maybe he's a real guy whose story has been exaggerated. But definitely in the world of ballad hunters, but also in English folklore, Ned Ludd, who's a person who probably didn't exist, has taken on something of a legendary, if not a mythological, sheen. And so the sheen comes from busting up machines. So, Ken, why don't you ground us in the Luddite movement, if you can be heard, against the sound of industrial factory machinery being smashed up?
Yeah, the Luddite movement is, wildly enough, apparently the way that people determine, are you a part of the Luddites, is did you send a mean letter signing it Ned Ludd or General Ludd? The Luddite movement is one of many, many, many English workingmen's riot flare-ups, going back to Wat Tyler, at least. The machinery sabotage is not even new to the Luddites. That began in 1675 for the first time in the stocking trade, because the first thing you develop machines for is weaving, and the people who are thrown out of business are skilled weavers who are suddenly more expensive than people who can work a machine. Beloved communist historian Eric Hobsbawm refers to this phenomenon as collective bargaining by riot. And I love that phrase. So anyway, this specific movement begins in Nottinghamshire in March of 1811. By November 1811, it spread to Derbyshire. And it is a series of attacks on machinery and threatening letters being sent either to the newspapers, to pamphleteers, or to factory owners, or to the church in the town as seen as the sort of neutral arbiter. And it's like, Ned Ludd presents his grievances to God and sort it out, God, and that kind of thing.
Well, you know, it's going to go in the church newsletter right away. So
right, yeah.
You're sending it to the trustworthy media.
Right. In February of 1812, it spreads to Yorkshire. They attack a mill in Brighouse, and they assassinated a mill owner in Huddersfield, Yorkshire, in April. In Lancashire in February 1812, they're attacking textile mills, often with arson. And then in Cheshire in February 1812, they start attacking steam looms, which is different from the frames that are the normal things that they were attacking in Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire. And in Yorkshire, they're attacking carding machines, which are the machines that comb out the imperfections on cloth and on wool. And so that's a big thing. So in response to this, Parliament makes machine breaking a capital crime in March 1812. This is emergency legislation. They remit it back to life transportation in 1813, but it's done so that they can try 64 accused Luddites at York in January 1813. 17 of them are hanged, 4 of them for the assassination of the mill owner. 20 of them are transported, at least, and 30 of them are acquitted.
And transported means exiled to Australia.
Sent to Australia, yes. By then, that's where you were transported. They could no longer send you to Georgia or Connecticut, the penal colonies in America. And I think they'd stopped sending you to the Caribbean even by then. So yeah, it was Australia is where you got sent to. And then there was a sort of last hurrah of Luddism in Leicestershire. There was an attack on a lace-making factory in 1816. And then the last Luddite letter that we know of was sent in Derby in April 1817. And again, that was after another series of trials of the Leicestershire outragers. And so that last letter was, you'd better make sure this is an honest trial type thing. So they would, as you suggest, smash up the knitting frames, the shearing frames, the steam-powered looms, and all of these devices are basically meant to increase output with cheaper labor. And the reason that costs need to come down for the mill owners is that the Napoleonic Wars are ongoing, and Napoleon is not letting them export anything to Europe. And meanwhile, Britain is angering America, and America is starting to pass laws, including the Embargo Act under Thomas Jefferson, that say you can't send anything to America. So all of their markets are being closed off by British foreign policy. And so therefore, prices are crashing, and that is driving the mill owners to basically throw a ton of people out of work with no real concern about it.
Right. And by angering America, you mean the War of 1812.
I know this is before the War of 1812. This is the impressment of our sailors and general harassment of our trade on the Atlantic.
Okay.
This is
so in the lead up to it.
Right. Yes. But again, this goes back to Jefferson in 1809.
Right.
But the War of 1812 does begin in the middle of this and certainly does not help. And so the economic situation is continuing to get worse. Wars produce inflation. So there's inflation. Prices are rising. Also, relatively unrelated, there's a series of bad harvests in the north of England, and that drives food prices up. And so that's a bad situation all the way around as well.
Right. And so the interesting sort of mythic thing going here is this is a real movement involving real people smashing things up and getting really hung, but they've organized themselves around the idea of being a follower of a particular person who may or may not have literally existed, named Ned Ludd. And he gets promoted in some of these letters where people are essentially role-playing as him, writing in his alleged voice. So he sometimes signs himself Captain Ludd or General Ludd or even King Ludd. I think ballad hunters generally prefers General Ludd. Mm-hmm. And so who is the mythic figure that everyone sort of kind of wills into existence, dare I say Tulpa-like, in this bit of real revolt spawning folklore?
So the OG original Ned Ludd was supposedly a guy who made stocking cloth in Leicestershire, in Anstey. And at one point, his boss kept telling him, square up your needles, square up your needles, you know, tighten up your frame, your weave is too loose. And so he got sick of it and he took his hammer and he smashed up the frame. And as a result of that, you know, sort of in the story, he's either hung or he's beaten to death by the mill owner's people, or he vanishes into the woods, depending on which version of the story you like. There is no record of any Ned Ludd that we know of in Anstey, Leicestershire in 1779, but who can say they didn't keep a lot of records of everybody that worked at a stocking mill? The first print version of this legend comes out in early 1811 when people are trying to figure out who is Ned Ludd, and then they write this sort of origin story for him. So again, it's like Batman is beating up all the criminals in Gotham, and the criminals in Gotham are saying, who is this guy? How did he come to be? We have no idea. And that's what's going on. The magistrates, agents, and the secret committee of parliament did legitimately send people looking for Ned Ludd, a soldier who was one of the several, they say platoons, but it's a pretty big total deployment. It's basically about a division of troops are sent into the north to hunt the Luddites. The guy who wrote his memoirs of this hunt says that in his opinion, every ring of Luddites appointed one leader, and that leader took the name of Ned Ludd or General Ludd. And so that was just their sort of name for their leader was Ned Ludd, which does not necessarily mean it's not also a tulpa, obviously.
That's maybe how you get your tulpa, your gestalt tulpa creating activities.
And then there are variations on the story. There was an attack on Goodair's Mill in Edgeley in Stockport, and this is in March of 1812, and the crowd was led by two men dressed as women, referred to as General Ludd's wives. So we've got that energy going. And then at one point, there is a letter to a priest in Manchester in 1812 signed Eliza Ludd. So is King Ludd a being that transcends gender, or does King Ludd just have wives and girlfriends, as you so often do if you're a king? Who can say? There is an eyewitness to seeing General Ludd, a guy in the Bolton militia named Abraham Kay, later said that he saw one called General Ludd who had a pike in his hand like a sergeant's halberd. I could not distinguish his face, which was very white, but not the natural color. And I think that is strong, strong evidence for some sort of English chalk figure, tulpa, demigod being coming out. Very white, but not the natural color.
If this was happening in France, I would think about Carcosa, but That's a whole other kettle of fish.
Exactly. Well, it's not an either or, right?
Yeah. Now, like any other mythic figure, he has a super weapon.
Yeah. His hammer is called Enoch. The Yorkshire Luddites named their hammers Enoch after Enoch Marsden, the inventor of the cropping machines that they destroyed. So they had a poem that said, Enoch made it, Enoch slayed it. And that was good fun. They would say that.
I bet that burned him plenty.
It did burn him plenty. By 1812, I believe it's March or November, the ballad, The Triumph of General Ludd, is in print. There's another called Well Done, King Ludd, that becomes Welcome, King Ludd. And that's a different one, but that one did not get covered by Chumbawamba in 1988. And they did a recording of Triumph of General Ludd, which you can dial up now and listen to and be all vibey with the spirit of the rebellious North.
And there are other sort of mythic connections that you think about when you hear the King Ludd name. For example, it suggests that maybe has something to do with London, Ludd Dun,
yep,
or the builder of Ludgate.
Yep, that was legendary King Ludd. If you remember your Geoffrey of Monmouth, he's the son of King Belin, and he's the founder of London, and it's his town. And the notion is that this is the English version of the Welsh demigod Ludd La Arrant, Ludd of the Silver Hand, who is also the son of the sun god. And Ludd La Arrant is cognate with the Irish king of the Tuatha De Danann, Nuadha Argidlam. And Nuadha, we will all be very excited to learn, according to Professor Tolkien, and I defy anyone to find a better source than that, is cognate with Nodens, the good old Romano-British god of hunting and dogs and sleep, who ruled a whole different part of England rather than the Midlands. He was down in the Severn country, but still, he's there. And he's also, of course, our way to connect it up with the Cthulhu mythos, should you so desire.
Right. But in Ballad Hunters, it's not the mythos you look to as the cause of strange events and mythological figures emerging and reemerging. It's a strange phenomenon in which the events of folk songs are coming to life, sometimes manifesting supernatural beings, sometimes making ordinary people behave in a way that follows the lyrics of the song. And the player characters are sent by Sir Walter Scott to bust that up using their compass verses, these devices that have some power to turn the way that these supernatural events are happening. So one of the possible themes that you can come up with for your party of ballad hunters, a party template, as it's called, is Ludd's Widowed Weavers. So you can be a whole party of Luddites who've turned from the threat of automation to this greater threat of songs coming to life. And in the game, Ned has manifested and is a supernatural being. He's the embodiment of class warfare. And we mentioned earlier that he starts out in Nottinghamshire. Well, the supernatural manifested Ned Ludd takes full advantage of this, and he hangs out in Sherwood Forest, which, of course, is the home of a previous folk hero of the people, a battle of oppressors. So he's drawing on the myth pattern of Robin Hood. And so the characters can go and meet him, and they can admire his hammer Enoch. And while if they're there, a folk song might come to life, and they might also find themselves restoring order when people start turning into Robin Hood and Little John, which of course is the subject of many ballads, including one of the child ballads that Tristan references in the gang. And then finally, you can, without necessarily being Luddites yourselves, you can have Luddite pals and informants or just people you meet who let you know what the aristocratic baddies up on the hill are doing in this atmosphere of songs coming to life and so forth. So Ned Ludd is one of the more fun, more mythological figures you can interact with in a Ballad Hunters session or campaign.
Yeah, I do want to caution people who are go up to Ned Ludd and clasp his hand and talk about how much they like Robin Hood. In Triumph of General Ludd, it opens with the lines, "No more chant your old rhymes about old Robin Hood. His feats I do little admire. I'll sing the achievements of General Ludd, now the hero of Nottinghamshire." So there seems to be a beef between Ludd and Robin. Maybe it's just that Ned Ludd as a Tulpa is drawing on Robin's old energies and Robin resents it. But I might not go too deep into the greenwood with my frame smashing hammer and my Luddite pals, lest I be filled with ghostly cloth yard shafts. Because remember, for all his other virtues, Robin is an aristocrat and it probably doesn't hold with his foolishness. Just saying.
Right. Well, now that we've issued that important warning, it's time for us to head on in to another hut. But wait, there's an exciting commercial first.
Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality-shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Do what your mother says and join such beloved Patreon backers as...
John Biscoe.
Matt Farr.
Mike Coleman.
Thomas Edward.
And Tristan Knight.
The jingly hat of Punchinello, the white dress of Columbine, and the confused exclamation of the Baxter welcome us once more into that most dramatically populated of huts, the Stock Character Hut. And today in the Stock Character Hut, we talked about fathers last time. Well, mom standing there with a rolling pin tapping her foot, saying behind every stock father, there is an equally stock mother. And Robin, you are going to unfold like a series of beautiful Mother's Day bouquets, the Stern Matriarch. And I'm going to tell you, I saw the list of Stern Matriarchs you had made, and I said, you know what? I don't need to help. I'm not going to find a single Stern Matriarch. Ordinarily, I'd have been diving into Roman legend because that's where most of your Stern Matriarchs enter the Western cultural stream. But I said, you know what? We got a lot of moms to categorize, so I'm going to leave you to it.
Yes. And interestingly enough, the older forebears are not quite as evident. And I think that obviously reflects the increasing status of women in later centuries. And so we usually start out with a Shakespeare, but he only has one such character, and that's in Coriolanus, which is not exactly the one that is tripping to everybody's mind. So yeah. I'm going to start in the 20th century with, first, I guess I should start with what is the role of the Stern Matriarch? Yeah. So in Page Turners, for example, a game of personal drama, which is at the Palgrane Web Store now and will be in retail in a few days. If you pick as a supporting character to have an unmet need with, having your mom be one of the people that you do not get what you want from is something that is very powerful and relates to a lot of people's real lives, but also is the other side of the pattern of the disapproving father who you need to please in order to establish, for example, a romantic relationship. A great example of that appears in Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. Jessica Tandy plays Lydia, who is the disapproving mother of the Rod Taylor character, the male hero, and Tippi Hedren's character, has to win her over. She even learns ahead of time that she's met another ex-girlfriend whose shot of happiness with the Rod Taylor character is gone because of Lydia. And this is all sort of the emotional backstory that is gathered just before a whole bunch of birds show up and try to kill everybody for no reason right. in that brilliant film. And if there's an explanation for what's going on, maybe it's related to this psychodrama, but definitely Tippi's ability to get pecked by birds finally helped win Lydia over. And this is often the pattern of winning over, gaining the affection of the mother and going in this case, it's not your mother, it's your prospective mother-in-law, of going from rival for your son to prospective daughter, essentially. You can flip this on its head where the disapproval is directed at a male character. There's a kind of obscure but fun Roald Walsh Western from the 50s called The King and Four Queens. It's got Clark Gable in it, and he goes to this remote ranch where there's hidden gold, and there's four young women who are either the wife or the widow of the four sons of Jo Van Fleet's character. She's called Ma. She's got a rifle. And Clark Gable has to work around her disapproval to get at what he wants, which is either one of the women or the gold or maybe even both. And you see this a lot in Westerns. Sometimes the disapproving mother will be a metaphorical mother who's a woman who owns a ranch and treats all the ranch hands as her sort of surrogate sons, or sometimes her real sons are around. From history, as seen in The Lion in Winter, Eleanor of Aquitaine is played in the classic film by Katharine Hepburn, is a real-life disapproving mom who her sons had a lot of difficulty with. But maybe the most dangerous mom, the mom who, if you elicit her disapproval too much, is from I, Claudius. She'll poison you.
Yeah.
Because she's Livia, that classic character. That puts us in mind also of Livia Soprano from the early seasons of The Sopranos, played by Nancy Marchand. Her first name, not a coincidence. That's obviously done on purpose. Mm-hmm. The mother in a melodrama can be the source of emotional threat and trauma. In this case, that's directed not at this prospective daughter-in-law, but at the daughter. And so examples of that are seen in Mommy Dearest, in which Faye Dunaway plays Joan Crawford, or at least Joan Crawford's daughter's version of Joan Crawford, depending on whose story you want to believe. Barbara Hershey in Black Swan, she plays a character named Erica Sayers, who's clearly the psychic force contributing to the breakdown of the lead character played by Natalie Portman. And then sometimes the monstrous or difficult mother can appear in a comic role. And I think the sort of epitome of that is Throw Mama from the Train, where Anne Ramsey plays Mama Lift, and she got a Academy Award nomination for being the mother who it would be amusing if something terrible happened to.
Right.
Now, the difficult mother character from whom the main character wants something and has a conflict with, it doesn't have to be a full-on stern matriarch. It can just be like a fraught or a difficult relationship. So, for example, the film Lady Bird, Laurie Metcalf plays Marion McPherson, based on the filmmaker Greta Gerwig's own mom, and I think presented perhaps a little more harshly than she thought she was doing.
Yeah.
In Autumn Sonata, the Ingmar Bergman film, Ingrid Bergman plays Charlotte Andergast, and she's an example of the distant parent who must be won over. Sometimes the pattern, you will see the full arc. The character who wants something from the mother actually gets it, and the character goes from stern to supportive. Emily Watson, who plays Emily Shakespeare in Hamnet, follows that arc. In the Anne of Green Gables books, Marilla Cuthbert is also a classic example of that pattern, where initially she's distant toward Anne because they were expecting a boy to come and work their farm, and they're none too happy with her nonsense. But of course, it becomes a story of fierce love, so that undergoes the whole arc there. At times, we talked about the father role being deflected into other non-literal fathers, and that happens again with the mother. So like an undermining head housekeeper who's the main woman in the house before our protagonist enters it and is threatened by them. She is in a way a mother figure. She's a mother of the house, if not of the romantic lead. And so Mrs. Danvers in Rebecca is a big example of that. The character Millie in another Hitchcock film, Under Capricorn, does the same thing. and there's assorted mean aunts, and of course your evil stepmothers are an example of a deflection, right? You can't have a conflict with your mother. That would be bad. Your mother can't want to poison you or leave you in the forest or what have you. But a stepmother, boy, they will do that. And it's much harder.
In a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And the mean aunt can be, obviously, like the throw mama from a train can be tuned for comedy, like good old Aunt Agatha in the P.G. Wodehouse Bertie and Jeeves stories, where she has all of the terrible unspoken power of a mother, but she's an aunt, but Bertie is still helpless before her powers. So right. Again, it's a comic foil type character.
And it's because it's deflected, it's funnier.
Right.
If that relationship was with his mom, it would be too real and hurtful, but and just sad. Make it an aunt. And then just dial it up to 11 and you've got hilarity ensuing. We can then go from the stern matriarch is sometimes the matriarch, not just of a family, but of a crime family.
The best kind of family.
Yeah. And I guess the archetypal example of that is Ma Jarrett from White Heat, played by Marlette Wickerly. And her relationship with the Jimmy Cagney character is one of the classic psychodramatic gangster dynamics.
Right.
A newer film that has exactly that difficult, and in this case, with elements of incestuous feeling creeping in, is from The Grifters, where Angelica Houston plays Lily Dillon, and one of the great criminal mom characters of all time. The show Sons of Anarchy, Gemma, played by Katie Sagal, who's, of course, also Lady Macbeth, is both a protective mom keeping the love interest away from her son, but also a difficult moral figure herself. And is she in the crime gang? Is she a moderating force in the crime gang? And that's many, many seasons of ups and downs with that character. And a historical figure, Ma Barker, is shown in various films, including Bloody Mama with Shelley Winters. So she's a criminal mom based on history, the way that Eleanor of Aquitaine is also based on history. And there's the comic version of this appears in John Waters' Serial Mom, where Kathleen Turner, as the title implies, goes on a bit of a kill spree. And that is so satirically poignant that her character's name is just Mom. That's all you need.
And another great example of the criminal mom as Lady Macbeth is Kristen Scott Thomas as Crystal Thompson in Only God Forgives, the Nicholas Winding Refn sort of criminal psychodrama. And that's another, you know, overpowering example of the archetype, I think, is something you can say about it.
And because we're talking about this on this show, we should mention the horror mom. I don't think we talk so much about horror dads, like as in Stepfather, but certainly right. Stephen King's Margaret White, the mom in Carrie, is the archetype of archetypes when it comes to the horror mom. She's basically generating the psychic damage that it literalizes in the story of Carrie. Recently, we had Sally Hawkins do an amazing turn as Laura in Bring Her Back, where she is both a sympathetic grieving mom and the terrifying antagonist of that mm-hmm. Film. And who could forget the mother from Barbarian, literally a monstrous mom,
right.
Played by Matthew Patrick Davis. So the nature of the relationship of a mother and her children, or a mother and her surrogate children, or a surrogate mother and her symbolic children, is incredibly rich for any form of drama. And some of these characters we've mentioned already are in procedurals, but they add emotional weight to that. So, of course, in a game like Page Turners, which is all about setting up emotional relationships, identifying what you need from the supporting characters and why you can't get it. Mothers, of course, play a big role. So in the Shakespearean comedy, Love's Loyal Laborers, there's the quietly in charge Lady Bentivall. She's cold, and contrasting with her blustering husband is the one who is really in command of what's going on and who the characters have to win over. And then she has a opposite number on the other side of this couple that you're trying to get together. That's Lady Pamphlet, and she's a mother to the female romantic lead. And she is also a stuffed shirt, as well as a mother who needs to be won over. So she's doing double stock character duty. In Sarah Sam Saltiel's Without You, which is about a mortal woman who is beloved by a vampire and is dying and does not want to become a vampire, you can call flashback scenes with her disapproving mother, Lenora. And so she's just literally labeled as a disapproving mother. So precisely is she locked into that archetype. And in some of the others, the mother characters appear in backstory. They're referred to as a way of sort of explaining why your protagonist has the restlessness and unease that propels them into the story. And that's true, for example, in The Beacon, which is the Fitzgerald pastiche, or in Wade Rockett's True Rock Stories, Lizzie Liar, which is basically a behind the music style docudrama that you create. So whenever you're looking for somebody who you want something from and you can't necessarily get it, look to your fictive mom or quasi-mom.
Well, before our mom calls us in for supper, because we've spent too long outside playing in the stock character hut, we should probably detour through the ad and emerge safe in a different hut, away from her stern gaze.
The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York. Town.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. The clacking of chronotons and the whirring of time gears tell us we're once more standing in proximity to Ken's time machine. This, of course, is the conveyance that his superiors at Time Incorporated used to send him back into history to bend, fold, spindle, and sometimes, yes, even mutilate it. This time around, we have a question, a mission, shall we say, from beloved Patreon backer Anders Gabrielsson, who asks, why was Ken sent to sabotage the formation of Bartitsu as the world's most powerful martial art? And Ken, this show is all about learning. And while researching this today, I learned that Bartitsu is a real martial art.
Yep.
I always thought of Baritsu, as it is referred to in Conan Doyle, who assigns this martial art to Sherlock Holmes. I thought he made this up, but it turns out, Ken, it's real.
Yep.
Doyle, as I said, changes the spelling a little, and I think he picks a better name than the real inventor of this martial art. But Ken, tell us about the real inventor of this real, if now forgotten, martial art.
Right. Holmes refers to it as you say, Baritsu, the Japanese system of wrestling. And it basically is how he slips Moriarty's grasp at the side of Reichenbach Falls and throws Moriarty over his shoulder into the waterfall to die. And that sounds, everyone says, that sounds like jujitsu. And indeed it is, because an English engineer named Edward William Barton Wright spent 3 years in Japan. He was had a lifelong interest in self-defense systems. And this is when judo and jujitsu dojos are becoming a thing in Japan, as it is industrializing and becoming middle class. And he, you know, falls in with those folk and learns enough jujitsu to bring it to England. And he brings it along with the other martial arts that he knows or has practiced: boxing, savate, the kick martial art of the French, and lacan, a kind of stick fighting invented by a Swiss stick fighter named Vignier. And he builds those four arts into a cross-training martial arts system that he names Bartitsu, and founds the Bartitsu Club in 1899.
Right. And if you're asking yourself, listeners, Does this martial art have a class component? Well, let's pick up a issue of the Pall Mall Gazette from August of 1898. At this point, the English press, in something Ken, neither of us have ever heard of before or since, is whipping up a frenzy, selling some papers, and perhaps advancing a political agenda by whipping up a street crime scare. So at the August bank holiday, there are a number of different unrelated street crimes, and they decide that this is hooliganism with a capital H, and this is where the term is first coined. And they tie this into Bartitsu, to the PR advantage of Edward William Barton Wright. And they write, "The chief objects of the promoters of Bartitsu is to provide a means whereby the higher classes of society may protect themselves from the attacks of hooligans and their like all over the world." And so I gather this possibly had a bunch of people come over to sign up, which is why he sets up his club the next year.
Right. Yeah. It drives interest in various kinds of self-defense. Just as a side note, the term hooligan comes from a street gang called the Hooligans, which is so named because it was run by an Irish guy named Houlihan. And so Houlihan became hooligan, became hooligans, but using it as a generic term for street criminals is yet more beloved anti-Irish sentiment from the Pall Mall Gazette, etc. So the job of Bartitsu is self-defense at every range. So you use your cane, your walking stick, if they're far enough away, they get closer, you kick them with savate, they get closer yet, you box them, they get into a clinch, ha-ha, you have the secret technology of jujitsu.
Yes. Your first through three defenses just lulled them into a sense of security so you could clinch them close up.
Right. Well, Barton Wright knows that this is not necessarily the winning move, and that if you can beat them with a stick, you absolutely should. But he also knows
that if you're in the higher classes, you're carrying a stick, so that's right. Convenient. Yeah.
Definitionally, you're carrying a stick, Robin. What are you, a farmer? Anyway, he also knows that he's not good enough at judo to teach people who are as good as him at judo. So he imports two more judojas from Japan, Japanese higher dan judo masters than him, and immediately starts getting into fights with one of them, who says, "Why is my name not on the sign?" and things like that. "And why do I have to fight all these sweaty boxers? That's not what I'm here for." But he does a lot of what we would now recognize very clearly as mixed martial arts bouts and combats. And so he has, you know, a great boxer against one of these judo guys. And sometimes the boxers are like, "This is against the rules." And he says, "That's the point of the rules." And much like MMA at the beginning, people are questioning it, but it becomes a sort of a draw, a fad at the very least. And so this sort of pragmatic eclecticism, scholars of martial arts say, you know who else was a great pragmatic eclecticist? Bruce Lee. Jeet Kune Do is, again, a combo of a bunch of martial arts meant for pragmatic value in a street fight. And that's the job of it. He'd always been a physical culture guy. In 1901, he brings a woman in who's an expert in breathing exercises. So he's always improving Bartitsu. And by the time he's sort of done tinkering with it, I think that it very much would resemble a very modern sort of a martial art. Again, Jeet Kune Do is, you know, 1960s and 70s. The physical culture combo with martial arts, that comes out of Tai Chi in the West. But it's, again, it's not really present in dojos until much later. But the trouble is, I guess street crime goes down. And also, he sets fees at the Bartitsu Club too high. In America, the great, you know, karate schools are all for middle-class parents who need to get little Jeremy out of trouble. And so they send him there. And he does not price his Bartitsu Club memberships for the middle class. And that's what ruins it.
Right.
So,
because, of course, the threat of upper class folks being attacked by hooligans was whipped up. It wasn't an actual epidemic that a lot of people needed to train themselves for. No.
Then as now, hooligans attack poor people, not rich people by and large.
Exactly. Well, they're carrying sticks. That's all you need.
And poor people can't afford club memberships. That's crazy talk.
Yes. So the fighting club goes out of business in 1902. His wellness offshoot continues a little while longer before also going spectacularly out of business. And I don't know how germane this is to your time travel escapades, but I had to fit it in.
Not remotely, but sure, throw it in.
Yeah. But this is a great little period detail that in the scenario of this, you have to work this in. So he's got a different company called the Bartitsu Light Cure. which is a wellness operation that bombards the ailing with, it's basically heat therapy, heat treatments, but he'll shoot such devices as the ultraviolet ray lamp, the light bath, the thermopenetration machine, and the Nagelschmidt apparatus at you. But again, there's not enough takers willing to pony up. And so that goes out of business in 1909 with a loss to shareholders of 22,000 pounds, which is a lot of Nagelschmidt apparatus money in that.
That's era. Right. The Nagelschmidt apparatuses are going cheap for them who know.
Right.
But the that again, that's basically diathermy, and that becomes a thing much later once you have more reliable heating pads, basically. So again, a man ahead of his time, but also a little bit of a promoter, a little bit of a hustler, but that's what we love about him, right?
Right. But you're going to land your machine before the Bartitsu light cure goes out of business.
Cause I exactly.
think your pivot point is in 1899.
Yeah. The reason that we're preventing Bartitsu from taking off is not just to put one in the eye of the Pall Mall Gazette and not just my great sympathy for Irish hooligans, but also because in 1899, Barton Wright has a Royal Command performance invitation before Edward Prince of Wales, the future Edward VII. And in our timeline, which is the one that I set up, he's set upon mysteriously by two toughs while he is bicycling in Margate, Kent, and he breaks his hand. And so he can't do his Royal Command performance. And in his command performances, what he would do is he would take on like seven guys, not all at once, but serially, and defeat them with Bartitsu and show off how good Bartitsu was. Because you'd look at this guy and you'd say, well, he's kind of big and tough, but he's not, you know, a strapping fighter. And then he would take on these strapping fighters. But if he does his command performance and gets Edward VII excited about Bartitsu, and Edward VII joins the Bartitsu club because he was, again, a big club going guy, and this is a chance to have a pretty lady help you breathe, which is probably a priority for him then and now, he would bring a lot of wannabes and looky-loos into Bartitsu and throw it up. And so it becomes a common thing for people in the English upper classes to join, and maybe even the upper middle classes, because again, Edward was all about the money. He didn't really care who your father was. As long as you could pay Edward's bar tab, he was happy. So if we look over to Japan at roughly this same time, a little bit later, there's a guy named Morihei Ueshiba who invents another basically pragmatic martial art, Aikido and Aikijutsu. And he becomes the patron of a group of right-wing martial arts enthusiasts, the Sakurakai, the Cherry Blossom Society. His patrons are in the Black Ocean, the hardcore Japanese expansionist society. So the possibility of right-wing infiltration of a martial arts dojo is established historically. And with Barton Wright and his people going back and forth, Barton Wright, as far as I can tell, unexceptional politically, just sort of a straight up, you know, maybe a liberal voter, maybe a conservative voter, certainly in no wise a problem child.
He seems to be mostly a striver, right? He's
right,
an ambitious guy trying to create businesses.
But first of all, he's not going to be in charge of what every club does. And if money is coming in from, say, the Cliveden set or the Astors or whoever, he's not going to be able to get around that. And Edward VIII is a keen sportsman, a fan of all martial arts and physical combat, loves to box, or at least thinks he loves to box, loves to watch boxing, big patron of boxing, professional class golfer, big polo player. His family actually moves him into golf because they're worried he'll break his neck playing polo, and an amateur pilot. So he genuinely has pretty good reflexes. So if Edward VIII gets into Bartitsu, by now a ongoing, moving, increasingly right-drifting martial art, and he brings all of his wannabe fascist cronies in with him, suddenly we have a trained cadre of proto-fascist martial arts enthusiasts running around London in the 1930s, and that might be just enough to cause street riots, and maybe the Battle of Cable Street goes the other way, and the communists don't win. And we have the fascists being really good at street fighting in London. And, well, we know what happens when fascists get really good at street fighting, Robin. Italy, and then Germany, and also Japan. And maybe we don't want that in England. So maybe what you've got to do is take your time machine back to 1899, find a couple of guys who hate mustaches in Kent and say, the guy with the most insane mustache you can imagine is going to come bicycling along this road. Here is a giant bottle of alcohol for the both of you. There are another giant bottle of alcohol after you mess him up. And right. I think that prevents...
He'll be carrying his stick, and he's got four tactics, and here's how to evade each of those four tactics.
Right. But he's on a bike, so he can't do half of them already. That's the trick.
And also,
right?
There's two of you,
yeah,
which is a big assist as well.
A big problem. And that is what prevents Edward VIII's Bartitsu fascist clubs, Bartitsu shirts, from taking over Britain in the 30s. You're welcome, everyone. Also, you're welcome, those two Margate thugs. So there we are. That is my necessary intervention to prevent the Jeet Kune Do of the 1890s from taking off. If you are looking for a gumshoe treatment of Bartitsu, you can find it in my Ken Writes About Stuff Martial Arts Gumshoe Zoom. There's gumshoe stuff on Bartitsu right there, so pick that up.
Well, other than that, it seems like a great idea to have some great high Victorian adventure in the 1890s. Possibly your Yellow King characters from Paris can come over and get some martial training and perhaps submit themselves to the Nagelschmidt apparatus. So that sounds very exciting and gameable, and therefore we can pat ourselves in the back, making sure we don't whack ourselves with our sticks and declare victory over yet another podcast. But we'll be back with a new episode a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games,
Pelgrain Press,
Arc Dream,
Flagbearer Games,
Dark Tower,
and Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep the hammer of underfunding at bay by joining such backers as
Andy Shockney,
Joe Webb,
Vic Politis,
Chad Ward,
and Chris McCarthy.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.